The following is for your ears only. On Air, the new name for Newsweek On Air. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Eddie Robinson, and we have newsmakers, experts, and reporters to bring you these stories.
Temblers from Tunisia, street protests, and social networks drove out the Tunisian dictator and now spark protests in Egypt, Yemen, and beyond. But to what end?
State of the Union, also of Obama and the GOP, of politics and the economy heading toward election 2012.
State of the states, daunting debts and the lure of bankruptcy, but are both overstated.
Clash on the crash. What was to have been a definitive diagnosis of the nation's fiscal meltdown breaks down along party lines.
And the nominees are also some latecomers to the big screen and what's ahead from Sundance.
Plus notable quotes from last week's news.
All that and more for your ears only, a production of Gatewave Incorporated, the nonprofit volunteer 24/7 radio reading service that brings vital information and enrichment to those who can't see. For your ears only, for the week of January 30th, I'm David Alpern.
I'm Eddie Robinson.
I continue to call on the regime to understand that they better be listen quickly, not use violence, and understand that change has to come. There's no other option.
Street protests continued last week in Tunisia as demonstrators demanded removal from government of all veterans of the regime they had already ousted. More dramatic still were similar demonstrations the Tunisian uprising sparked, heavy with disaffected but internet-connected young people in places as different as poor Yemen and powerful Egypt, where Nobel Peace Prize winner Mohamed El-Baradei returned to help lead the reform movement. With flame and tear gas adding a sense of history in the making, 30-year Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak announced he would form a new government, but not exit himself.
The confrontations in Egypt were a challenge both to Mubarak and to President Obama and Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. They value Egypt's support in the region, but also see the danger of opposing a true democratic uprising and the opening that could give to anti-American Islamist forces. To talk about the ideology, technology, and diplomacy at play, for your ears only, we're joined by Jean-Pierre Filliou, historian and Arab expert at the Institute of Political Studies in Paris, currently a visiting professor at the Columbia University School of International and Public Affairs. His books include Apocalypse in Islam and The Nine Lies of Al-Qaeda. Welcome to our program.
As we record this week's show, we see escalating conflict in Cairo and reports that El-Baradei might have been detained or at least kept from leaving a mosque he had visited. Are you surprised at the speed with which the spirit of Tunisia was picked up and escalated in Egypt?
Honestly, yes, but like everybody else. But at the same time, I was in Egypt on April 6, 2009, when a single Facebook group was able to just shut down the city by calling for a virtual strike that turned very real. So there was a potential, obviously.
What do you make of Mubarak's plan to replace his government, though not himself?
Well, you know, after so many days when Egyptian officials said we're not going to give any concession because that was the way it started to go down for Ben Ali the moment he conceded anything, well, obviously they understood at least part of the message from the street and they got ready to make a move. But let's assess what is serious and deep is that move.
Is El-Baradei a likely political leader after years at the International Atomic Energy Agency and other overseas postings?
Of course, he's a person very respected in Egypt. His main liability, I must admit, is that he's not spending time enough in Egypt. The fact that he had to come back to join the movement, that he was not inside of the country, being at the heart of it, is already a sign of that. But one has also to see that in Tunisia, as well as in Egypt, it's not a leader-led movement. It's basically amorphous movement with a very significant youth factor, internet, Facebook factor, and they are not doing that to support this man or that man. But certainly a national symbol will be needed to embody the alternative if there is an alternative in the picture.
In Tunisia, we heard reports of the army refusing to shoot fellow citizens. In Egypt, we heard about police shedding their badges and uniforms to join the crowds. Now, does this suggest a greater interior opposition than we knew?
Well, first, the strongest ministry in Tunisia was and still is Ministry of Interior, while in Egypt it is a defense. So the fact that the army in Tunisia refused to shoot the demonstrator was also a way as a weak party to join the protest movement. In Egypt, the contrary. The main issue would be if in the military in Egypt, people decide not to go after the demonstrators, and until now there is absolutely no sign about it.
What role in the uprisings or their aftermath do you see for the Islamic parties, whose commitment to continuing democracy is very much a question to many Americans?
You know, I'm French. And in May 68, during the student uprising, the Communist Party was pretty much against the student leftist and pacifist. And it was, in fact, a conservative party when it came to law and order. By many standards, the Islamist parties today are playing the same game because they are afraid of this movement. They don't know a thing about it. They can't manipulate it. It's coming from places they have no idea about. So two days ago, the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt tried to join the movement, but even on that day, they were only a small part of the picture. They are not behind the movement, and probably they won't be the first one to benefit from it.
Was the government shutting down the internet a master stroke or an admission that the Mubarak cannot coexist with the essence of modernity?
By doing that, they're certainly on the very short term, maybe 24 to 48 hours, buying time. But it's pathetic because it shows once more that they are trying to wage a war of the past against their own people. Because anyway, Al Jazeera is broadcasting the news. Anyway, people are aware through phone and cell communication of what is happening. So even if there is not the plus of the internet, they will still be protesting, and they have been, even after the ban on internet.
What role for dissent in the region has been played by the WikiLeaks revelations of corruption and Washington's awareness of it, complicity for geopolitical reasons?
This is basically a Western issue. It has been very much debated over there, but nothing was surprised, and nobody learned a lot from those WikiLeaks. It was much more an issue in America or in Europe. So I don't think one should overvalue this factor and this surprising. It's basically Tunisia that was the spark of this regional movement. And because Tunisia was and is still so modern, so advanced socially and in terms of education and roles of women, in a way it played quite a pioneering role in what we see all over the region.
What is your appraisal of the Obama administration's response to the uprisings, first in Tunisia?
Well, in Tunisia, the Obama administration was very decent, and I think its behavior all along the crisis was very respected by all the Democrats, especially the praise of the courage of the Tunisian people in front of the repression. Now the challenge is much higher for America in Egypt, because basically it is a key partner in the region for America, certainly, especially after the Obama speech in Cairo in June 2009, but of course in the peace process with Israel. And immediately this will give a new dimension to any response to the democratic movement.
Jean-Pierre Filieu is a historian and Arab expert at the Institute of Political Studies in Paris, currently a visiting professor at the Columbia University School of International and Public Affairs. His books include Apocalypse in Islam and The Nine Lives of Al-Qaeda. Next, the State of the American Union, Obama and the GOP, for your ears only.
We're back for Your Ears Only. I'm Eddie Robinson.
I'm David Alpern.
This is our generation's Sputnik moment. 2 years ago, I said that we needed to reach a level of research and development we haven't seen since the height of the space race. And in a few weeks, I will be sending a budget to Congress that helps us meet that goal.
The president focused a lot of attention on our economy in general, and on our deficit and debt in particular. He was right to do so. And some of his words were reassuring. As chairman of the House Budget Committee, I assure you that we want to work with the president to restrain federal spending.
Unless we fully repeal Obamacare, a nation that currently enjoys the world's finest health care might be forced to rely on government-run coverage. That could have a devastating impact on our national debt for even generations to come.
President Obama's exploitation of Sputnik and the space race in last week's State of the Union address may have gone over the heads of some younger Americans, and there was some irony in it coming just days short of 25 years since the fatal launch explosion of the space shuttle Challenger. For Republicans like Wisconsin Congressman Paul Ryan, who gave his party's official response, much of the investment called for by Obama to, quote, win the future was just spending that adds to an ever heavier national debt.
But at least Ryan held out more hope for bipartisanship than the separate Tea Party reaction of Minnesota Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann. To put the State of the Union of Obama and of the GOP in perspective, for Your Ears Only, we're joined again by Stephen Hess, a veteran of various Republican and Democratic administrations, now Senior Fellow Emeritus at the Brookings Institution. Welcome back to our program.
Thank you.
What was your reaction to Obama's address, and specifically, did he make a good case for the Sputnik moment in our pinched economic times?
The address ultimately was very effective politically. That is, it moved him to the center. The charge has been that for 2 years, the first 2 years of his administration, he moved farther to the left than really the American people are or wanted to be. So this was a repositioning. It was part of a repositioning, of course, that started with the lame duck session of Congress and his response there. He had a little wind in his back because of the elegant speech he gave in Tucson. And I think this speech had at least a modest optimism, which I think Americans want. We are an optimistic country. We've been in a depression, and now we want the president to lead us out. So he had the tone right.
What about his emphasis on investment, as if Americans didn't understand it as a form of spending?
Well, again, he understands the question of globalism and technology as basically the driving force of the world's economy. And he did stress it. It may have been sophisticated, but on the other hand, he related it to jobs. The jobs, unfortunately, in many cases, just as with his own stimulus package, are not the jobs that are shovel ready and be created tomorrow. And that's to that degree, there is space between him and what Americans really want, which is jobs, jobs, jobs.
Economists disagree about the role of government spending as a key to economic revival versus tax cuts and deficit reduction. But is there some lesson in the new statistics on slower growth in Great Britain under its current government's austerity plan?
Well, here is it. Here's what we have. We have, and it's a very helpful thing to have because we have two parties in the United States. If they agreed, we'd have a party too many. They have very different philosophies. Based on very different economic projections and theories, and the Republicans, as rather clearly stated, I thought, by Paul Ryan, the young congressman from Wisconsin, who will now head the Budget Committee, so he is the key person in this regard, and they believe in a cut, 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 and that's not what the president is doing. The president, on the other hand, is giving lip service and some small gestures to cutting, but he says, yeah, we've got to cut, but we better get through some of this recession first, and that's the difference. And they can both, to relate to your question, Eddie, they can both relate to experiences that are happening in the rest of the world. One can look at Greece, the other can look at Germany.
What did you make of the bipartisan seating arrangement, the lower level of partisan outbursts? Congressman Ryan's talk about cooperation. Is there a real chance for civility and legislative compromise as we saw in that lame duck session?
Well, I think the two questions, civility, yes, compromise, I would be skeptical of. Remember, we're 2 years into a presidential contest. The president will be running for re-election, which means, of course, that his agenda will be largely directed on what he can do to put himself in the best position to run again. The Republicans are in a little more awkward position in that regard. That is, usually by this time in the presidential cycle, there's a distinct front runner in the opposition party. There's not right now, which means that there'll be six or eight candidates wanting to run, and there'll be a good deal of pyrotechnics in the Republican Party first, and that, of course, relates in part to the third speaker that you introduced us to, Obama, then Ryan, who will certainly represent the mainstream Republican response as we go into 2012, and then the Tea Party position, which, of course, the Tea Party isn't a party at all. It's a movement, and we're starting to see how strong it really is. It may be a real problem for the Republican Party as they move forward, and in some ways, it's a real asset for the Democrats, because the sort of statements that we hear from Sarah Palin and now from Michelle Bachmann certainly tend to unite Democrats.
Steve, you mentioned global trends. We would be remiss in this week not to ask your view of how Obama and Secretary of State Clinton are handling last week's ever more violent ferment in the Middle East, first on Tunisia, then Yemen, most importantly now with key ally Egypt.
Well, at this point, they're doing all that they can do, which is, of course, keeping their fingers crossed and noting that all of this is pretty much out of their control. I think the Secretary of State's statement have been useful. We can't certainly be in a position where we're against democratic movements, and yet at the same time we know that mixed into that is Islamic movements. Moreover, of course, some of these people, notably Mubarak in Egypt, have been very strong supporters of the United States. We need them for other reasons. This may be the great unanticipated consequence of the next 2 years. We always talk about unanticipated consequence, and they can have good or bad effects for a president. They can have good effects, as in the case of 9/11 and George W. Bush, or they can have bad effects, as in the case of Katrina and George W. Bush.
Stephen Hess is a veteran of various Republican and Democratic administrations, now senior fellow emeritus at the Brookings Institution.
Quote from the news, he was looking at websites related to lethal injection and websites about famous assassins. That was an unnamed official on computer searches, suggesting premeditation and an understanding of right and wrong by Jared Loughner, shortly before his Tucson marketplace shooting that left six dead and 12 injured, including Arizona Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords. Loughner has pleaded not guilty. Giffords has begun rehab.
Up next, the state of the states, with big financial problems of their own and fewer ways than Washington has to deal with them. For your ears only.
We're back for Your Ears Only. I'm David Alpern.
And I'm Eddie Robinson.
It's time now to restore California to fiscal solvency and put us on the road to economic recovery and jobs.
Fiscal solvency is an even greater challenge at the state level than in Washington, which, after all, has a unique ability to print money as well as borrow it. And California's once and future Governor Jerry Brown is hardly alone in facing the problem. According to a report by the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, 44 states and the District of Columbia are projecting shortfalls for the fiscal year beginning in July. There's been talk of a federal bailout or even some unique new form of state bankruptcy to ease the burden of civil service pay and other contractual obligations, though surely with reduced bond market appeal in the bargain.
Is this likely, inevitable, or an exaggeration that only captures headlines and increases public doubts about government at all levels? For your ears only, we put these and related questions now to one of the experts who worked on that Center on Budget and Policy Priorities report and several follow-ups. She's Elizabeth McNichol, Senior Fellow on State Fiscal Issues. Welcome to our program.
Thank you.
First, give us some examples of the biggest current state operating budget gaps out there in dollars, but also as a proportion of the state's budget.
Well, if you look at the gaps, largest gaps in dollars, some of the largest states, California, Illinois, Texas, New Jersey, and New York have the largest gaps. If you look at as a percent of budget, which is really the best way to compare state to state, it's those same states, but New York drops off the list, and you would add Nevada.
But in some more recent reports, your center has noted that there's been something of a false alarm over potential state and local bankruptcy, incorrectly combining current operating budget gaps with long-term financial obligations. Explain that distinction.
The numbers I was just talking about, or the states I was just talking about, are the ones that face the biggest gap on it for next year between the revenue they expect to collect and what they need to spend on education, on healthcare, and on the other general operations of the state. In addition, states borrow money, but when they borrow money, it's not to fill in those operating gaps. It's for, like, building a school building or working on roads, so it's for capital and infrastructure, and they pay them off over many years. In addition, states pay pensions to their employees. They also have many years to pay off those promises. Some analysts or observers are taking those two, that the current year operating deficits that are a result of this, the cyclical problems, the fact that the economy is just coming out of a recession, and then equate them and add them up to the debt that they have to pay off over the next few decades.
Under the current law, without a specific bankruptcy option for states, what happens if a state simply cannot cover operating expenses or interest obligations on bond issues or other borrowing?
Well, first, almost every state, their interest obligations for bonds, paying off their bonds, is one of the first or second things that they would pay. States just take what money they have, and no state's revenues are going to zero, so they'll pay off the bondholders. It is a case that because revenues are about 12% below where they were at the start before the recession hit, that there's a gap between their operating expenses and the amount of revenue they have on hand. And in order to deal with that, states will cut spending if they can't cover their operating expenses. And they do have the option of raising taxes.
What would a bankruptcy law for states look like as you hear it being discussed now?
I haven't seen real specifics because there's constitutional prohibitions against the federal government, imposing bankruptcy on states because states are their own sovereign entities and have many sovereign powers. So it's hard for me to say what this law might look like. And if it followed existing bankruptcy law, it might include things that allow states to get out of some of their obligations, say to bondholders or to things that they've negotiated with their employees or other debtors, people that are supply services.
Well, you mentioned state sovereignty. Does a state have the power under its sovereignty to create its own bankruptcy law for itself?
I haven't heard that being discussed. And states, the governors put out a statement recently. States are not looking for a bankruptcy option.
The Center for Budget and Policy Priorities has formally opposed the idea of a state bankruptcy law, but also of hasty changes in the formulas used to rate state creditworthiness for bond sales, specifically the weight placed on healthcare obligations, funded and unfunded pension. Why not broaden the profile that prospective lenders can consult?
I've got 2 points here. Some of the drawbacks of the bankruptcy option that's being discussed, in our opinion, is that it'll make the ability of states to come to solutions harder, not easier. Right now, there's tough choices that need to be made. And in order to get all the parties to sit down and make those tough choices, you don't want to have this option out there of, well, let's just throw up our hands and push it to bankruptcy. And it's also creating uncertainty in the bond market that's going to raise costs for states. But then to the question of, why not look at all aspects of a state's fiscal situation in order to assess their creditworthiness. I think that's happening. There was a recent report. The Governmental Accounting Standards Board is an organization that promulgates rules for states about what they have to report about their pension obligations. Back in the 80s, they wrote down the things that states have to tell people. The reason we know about these unfunded liabilities is because they've been in state financial reports, and the people in the bond market who are looking at the creditworthiness of states and local governments use that information as a part of their assessment of the creditworthiness.
But haven't we seen just last week that Moody's credit rating agency has moved to include state pension obligations in its calculation? Will that force others to follow, and with what impact on state borrowing ability in these tight times?
Well, if you look closely at the Moody's report, what they did is, I think they've always, well, for the last 5 years, they've published a ranking of state debt per capita or state debt as a share of the state's economy and rated the states. They now expanded that to include the pension, unfunded pension liability, and did those rankings. So it's a new report for the states, but they did say in the lead-in that they have always looked at that information. They just haven't presented it in one report where they rank the states next to each other.
Elizabeth McNichol is a senior fellow on state fiscal issues at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities in Washington.
Quote from the news, "Stop the presses." That was the frantic call made to the printer of Chicago mayoralty ballots after the Illinois Supreme Court agreed to reconsider a lower court order removing the name of former White House Chief of Staff Rahm Emanuel on the grounds he did not meet residency requirements. 300,000 ballots were put aside, and the high court subsequently ruled in Emanuel's favor.
Up next, clash over the credit crash, the persistent partisan split, for your ears only. We have more for your ears only. I'm Eddie Robinson.
I'm David Alpern.
This crisis was avoidable. Despite the expressed view of many in the circles of financial and political power that the crisis could not have been foreseen, there were many, many warning signs that were ignored or discounted. Second, we found widespread failures in financial regulation. Third, our report describes dramatic breakdowns in corporate governance and risk management.
The market and credit meltdown that shook the world in 2008 continues to cause pain and partisan controversy. As chairman of the official Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, Phil Angelides spoke for the Democratic majority in calling the disaster avoidable and placing greatest responsibility on heedless businessmen and government regulators. But Republicans on the commission refused to endorse that view, seeing more complex causation with fewer targets for blame or reform.
To consider the conflicting views and the mountain of evidence the commission compiled, for your ears only, we're joined again by National Journal Chief Correspondent Michael Hirsch. Welcome back to our show.
Happy to be here.
On the business side, talk about the chain of policies from the boardrooms of Wall Street to the local marketers of mortgages that were questionable from the start. How did the majority see that ball start rolling?
Attempted to present it as a broad and sweeping historical narrative, going back a couple of decades, a whole series of decisions made on deregulation, decisions made by regulators not to pay attention as, for example, the over-the-counter derivatives market grew from a few billion to one that was nominally worth several hundred trillion, all of it unmonitored by the U.S. government and by other governments. And then at the same time, the complicity of a lot of other parties, the Wall Street firms themselves, which rather greedily sought to bundle and securitize hundreds of billions of dollars of bad mortgages, the credit rating agencies, which look the other way while they give some of these same mortgages, or I should say mortgage securities, AAA ratings, and so it's a it's an attempt, I think, to honestly assess all of the culpability on many parts, but at the same time, not to say that because everyone was responsible, therefore no one was responsible.
What's the evidence on the role of the government-backed agencies Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and years of government policy to encourage home ownership by those further down the economic ladder?
Well, here is the, that was the perhaps key difference that caused different parts of the commission to section off into majority and dissenting views between Democrats and Republicans. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were deemed by the majority not to have been a central cause, even though they were caught up like every other major institution in the subprime mortgage securitization craze. Much of the debt that they themselves underwrote was not among the worst debt that defaulted most easily as the bubble burst. They were culpable in the sense that they took on huge amounts of leverage, 75-1, the report noted, which was actually far more than many of the major Wall Street firms. They did not cause it. Now, the Republicans, particularly one Republican, Peter Wallison, who wrote his own dissenting report, said that Fannie and Freddie had a much greater role.
In fact, there were reports early on that most of the really bad mortgages were not to first home buyers, but refinancing deals for people who already owned homes. Did that hold up?
Yeah, I think that there was, particularly in the latter stages of the bubble, as you get into the later 2000s, 2004, 2005, 2006, a lot of it was refinancing. A lot of it was just sheer scamming. To the point where, you know, in the final stages, you had this peculiar synthetic CDO concept of collateralized debt or obligations, bundles of mortgage-backed securities that were put together strictly intended to fail, so that short sellers in the market could make a huge amount of money off of them.
None of the panel's four Republicans signed on this report. What were their conclusions about the major causes of this financial crisis?
Well, you know, it was kind of interesting because in many respects they also they echoed some of the findings of the majority report in saying that there were many culprits involved. But they seemed intent not to put a finger on any individual. For example, whereas the majority Democratic report cited Alan Greenspan, perhaps as the most culpable public official, Ben Bernanke, Tim Geithner, who was then the New York Federal Reserve Chairman, and cited flaws and fallacies in the market, the U.S. markets. The Republicans sought to say that this was global. No individual was culpable. Regulatory failures were not really to blame. It was simply sort of these larger economic forces that caused the bubble. It seemed like an attempt, frankly, to my eyes anyway, to avoid laying blame on Wall Street and avoid laying blame on the free market concept that had led to all of this lack of regulation.
Congress has already passed the Dodd-Frank bill to overhaul financial regulation. How much impact do you think last week's report will have on the lengthy process of writing detailed regulations required by the new law?
I think that particularly the Republican dissenting report is going to have some influence on the efforts of Spencer Baucus, who is the new chairman of the House Financial Services Committee, who's already indicated that he's unhappy with Dodd-Frank, already indicated that he wants to water down some of the provisions of it, for example, dealing with over-the-counter derivatives. I think he's going to attempt to use this as some fuel for that effort. But frankly, simply because the report was so divided in its conclusions, even the Republicans themselves couldn't come to agreement, I think that its impact is likely to be not that great. What you may see, however, in the months and years ahead, is because the commission spent so much time accumulating a huge amount of evidence. They had subpoena power. They had the ability to get a lot of background documentation, and a lot of this is now up on their website. I think you're going to see journalists and historians spending a lot of time mulling over this, and so it could yield additional benefits in that respect.
During the news conference, it appeared the chairman sidestepped criminal prosecution subject matter. What can you tell us about reports that at least some evidence was forwarded to the Justice Department?
Well, they resolutely refused to comment on what kind of evidence, how many referrals there were, what kind of cases there would be. However, I did talk with two of the Republican members of the commission who really played down the impact of these referrals. One of them, Doug Holt-Deacon, an economist who was John McCain's former advisor, said that he said basically there's no there. He said most of the evidence that they turned up had already been considered by the Justice Department and the SEC, and that he did not think that there were going to be any major civil or criminal cases to come out of this. And frankly, I don't expect that there will.
Michael Hirsch is the chief correspondent for National Journal. Next, inside the Oscar nominations and new films at Sundance. For Your Ears Only.
We're back for Your Ears Only. I'm Eddie Robinson.
I'm David Alpern with this quote from the news. The last time there was a naked man covered in gold paint in my house, it was me. That was the notoriously secretive British artist Banksy, whose documentary on subversive street art, Exit Through the Gift Shop, won an Oscar nomination last week, which may draw him to attend the awards ceremony, perhaps even reveal his true identity.
They're going to go through an amazing journey for the next month. They're going to go through a time where they look back, and I hope all their memories are good ones.
If I rise on my tribe, all I get, all that
If I Rise is an apt theme song for the Oscar-nominated film 127 Hours about a boulder-trapped canyon climber. And the song won a nomination of its own last week. It's also a fitting anthem for all the nominees in all categories, but especially for the first-timers, for whom last year's supporting actress winner Monique had some sympathetic advice in an AP interview after her chores as a nomination announcer.
And even as the best of last year's film came back into the spotlight, with the usual chatter about nominations not received or not deserved, some new titles attracted attention at the annual Sundance Film Festival in Park City, Utah. To talk about both, for years only, we have Janice Page, movies editor at the Boston Globe. Welcome to our program.
Thanks for having me.
This year's Oscars doubled the number of Best Picture nominations from 5 to 10. Why did the Motion Picture Academy do this?
Well, they actually did it last year, and I think they liked it. It harkens back to before 1944, the Academy had 8 to 12 nominees for Best Picture, and then it went to 5 in 1944, and you know, I think last year they really realized that they wanted to give more films a chance to carry that nominee label. It makes economic sense, I'm sure. It gives those films that are out already some added lift, and it gives the ones that have already gone by the chance to be revived. I think that they would say it also broadens the category. You know, it allows for some films, a better mix of films. You can have your highbrow dramas, but you can also have, you know, family comedies and animation like Toy Story 3. You can have, you know, the summer entertainment blockbusters like Inception and a Western like True Grit and an indie film like The Winter's Bone, and you've got a really nice mix. Now, a lot of people would say that it also waters down the category, but that's debatable. So I think they're happy with the 10 films.
Two top contenders for Best Film, The Social Network about the high-tech founding of Facebook and The King's Speech about a stuttering British royal, certainly represent old world and new world in terms of subject matter. But are they both more traditional in filmmaking terms than a picture like Inception and therefore better bets with industry voters?
Yeah, you know, it's an interesting question, I think, and valid. I think that if you peel back the covers on both of those films, The King's Speech and The Social Network, while one, clearly The Social Network has the, you know, all the trappings of being a really modern film. It's about Facebook, it's about the Internet, it's got young people, really young people. It's got fast talking and it's fast moving. But, you know, you pull back the covers on that, and it is up against a very traditional film that would be considered Oscar bait in any year, kind of Miramax-style film. But if you look closely at The Social Network, it's still about the same types of themes that any one of the major contenders has ever been about. It's about the human condition, and actually you could make the argument that's exactly what it's about. It's about not losing ourselves and our humanity to this newfangled way. And there's nothing really that modern in the way it's filmed or made, but it is very crisply directed and edited, and it feels very modern. But I think that's a very valid point.
The Boston area took an unusual amount of pride over this year's nominations in many categories. Tell us about that.
Well, we like our Boston films and our Boston sports teams here, so we're big rooters for anything that carries the Boston stamp. But Yes, the social network and the fighter are both, you know, opposite ends of the spectrum, but darlings here. In addition, we had The Town this year and Conviction and, you know, many, many Boston films. The Company Men, Shutter Island didn't do quite as well, but are still heavily identified with Boston or the Boston area. And, you know, not since we've had one-offs in the years past. We've had Good Will Hunting and certainly The Departed, which won, and Mystic River and Gone Baby Gone, but not... We have never had a year quite like this. It's been a startling year for Boston films.
Let's switch from last year's films to what's coming, at least what's been introduced at the Sundance Festival, where the Globes, Wes Morris and Ty Burr, both were in the audience.
They kind of do a tag team approach to Sundance, and both have liked at least a few films among what they've seen. Wesley really liked a film called Pariah by Dee Reese. It's a kind of coming-out drama, a 17-year-old who... lives a very traditional existence by day and then frequents some lesbian nightclubs at night and is torn, trying to find herself. And he found it very, very moving. And he also liked Project Nim, which is a story of a chimp that some people will know. It is directed by James Marsh, who did the wonderful Man on Wire before this. It's a comedy, but it devolves into a very inhuman type of a film, and he found that very moving. And Ty, on the other hand, found How to Die in Oregon, which is a documentary by director Peter Richardson about euthanasia, quite startling and deeply thoughtful on that subject, and also liked In a Better World, which may well win the foreign language Oscar, and also liked a film called Take Shelter, which stars Michael Shannon as a man who builds a shelter against all of the world's ills and evils in his backyard.
Janice Page is movie editor of the Boston Globe, and this has been For Your Ears Only.
Time for one more news quote. Once I started to realize I wasn't earning my money, I felt bad. That was retiring Kansas City Royals pitcher Gil Mesh on walking away from the remainder of a contract that would have meant $11 million this year despite his inability to play with a severe shoulder injury.
Hear For Your Ears Only anytime at iTunes News and Politics or PodcastBunker.com. Write us at DavidEarsOnly@gmail.com.
This broadcast was engineered by Chad Daly and Paul Roesk at Argo Studios with intern producer Michael So. I'm Eddie Robinson.
I'm David Alpern. For Your Ears Only is a production of Gatewave Incorporated, a 24/7 nonprofit radio reading service bringing vital information and enrichment to those who can't see. Learn how you can benefit or help at gatewave.org.
Now we're back with another archive segment. A major story on the show a year ago. I'm Michael So. This week last year, we considered the controversy over increasing use of antidepressant medications from our January 31st, 2010 Newsweek on-air broadcast hosted by David.
Down, make some dangerous suggestions, taunts you with those old depressing questions. You can tell yourself to quit, but you really must admit that there's something irresistible in down.
Some people may find their depression appealing or at least irresistible. Singer Susanna McCorkle experienced it herself and ultimately sought relief in suicide. But the number of Americans taking medication to ease their sometimes paralyzing psychic pain has grown from 13 to more than 27 million since 1996. And they spend about $10 billion annually on antidepressant drugs, adding to skyrocketing healthcare costs. Are they worth it? A major study in the January issue of the Journal of the American Medical Association suggests that only in the most severe cases is there significant effectiveness beyond the so-called placebo effect from sugar pills. A book just published this week agrees, The Emperor's New Drugs, Exploding the Antidepressant Myth by psychology researcher Irving Kirsch. Many other medical experts and drug manufacturers beg to differ, including bioethics expert Dr. Robert Klitzman of Columbia University. His book is When Doctors Become Patients, and he joins us now. But first, some background from Newsweek science editor Sharon Begley. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you, David.
What is the average difference in effectiveness between drugs and placebos?
Drugs have a slight edge compared to placebos, but if you lump together all of the kinds of antidepressants, as well as every degree of severity of depression, in other words, mild, moderate, severe, and very severe, the effect of the antidepressants seems to be 80% due to a placebo effect. In other words, patients believe that the medications are going to help them, and that belief gets them 80% of the way toward whatever relief they experience.
And you note that it may be the uncomfortable side effects of the antidepressants that gives them any edge at all in trials against placebos. Explain that.
It's very interesting research because, of course, when people volunteer for these studies, half of them receive the dummy pill and half of them receive the active medication, and no one is told who's getting what. But patients, because they experience side effects, which we've all read about in terms of antidepressants, can often tell which medication they're on. And if they figure out that they are on the active drug, their sense of hope, of expectation, soars, and that could be enough to make the active drug more effective than the placebo, the belief alone.
Yet you and others see a moral dilemma in spotlighting the truth about the placebo effect and antidepressants. Why?
Well, it's a catch-22. In the story, I recounted how a friend of mine came to me and said his physician was recommending that he try a new antidepressant because the old ones hadn't worked. And he asked me, you know, could I help him look at the research, et cetera. And it is a moral dilemma because if you tell people that the lion's share of the benefit of an antidepressant is because people believe in them, then if you, you know, sort of puncture that balloon and people do not believe in them, then suddenly the medications lose their effectiveness.
Newsweek, Sharon Begley. Next to Dr. Robert Klitzman of Columbia, welcome to Newsweek on Air.
Thank you.
You suffered a depression after 9/11 when your sister died at the World Trade Center. What were the symptoms?
Well, for a few weeks, I didn't feel like doing anything. I didn't feel like getting out of bed, watching TV, listening to music, reading, and I thought I had the flu.
You write about seeing your pain as a possible growing experience, but tried a lot of ways to escape it before antidepressants. Why were drugs your last resort, and how did they work for you in the end?
Well, in part, as I described in my book, When Doctors Become Patients, I first tried psychotherapy. I tried going to temple. I'm Jewish. I went to a church. I went to a Buddhist temple. And none of them seemed to do it. And then I decided to try antidepressants. I resisted it at first because I didn't want something artificial in my body, and I thought, well, I should be strong and tough it out. But in the end, they helped enormously.
And how does your own experience and that of your patients match the findings that antidepressants are only significantly more effective than placebo in the small number of most severe cases?
Well, it's an important issue. There's a lot of problems with the research. We're still in a young period of understanding these issues, but if you look at the research that's been done in the JAMA article and elsewhere, they don't look at how long people's depression has gone on, whether they've been depressed before, whether they've been mildly depressed for many years, whether they have a family history of depression. And most of them just look at a sort of 21-question scale, which you rate, for instance, do you feel depressed? You rate it from 0 to 4. Well, that's not going to capture the kind of depth of depression, the kind of severity of how much it impairs your life, what your quality of life is, how miserable you feel. So there's a lot of aspects of depression that aren't captured in the studies. And I would argue that even if we say that only, let's say, drugs may help only 20% of people who are depressed, given the fact that about 20% of Americans at some point in their life feel depression, it's millions and millions of people who can still be helped. And it's very hard to generalize from the sort of data on samples of people, even several thousand people, to oneself. It's like saying, you know, the odds of being in a car accident are very small, so you shouldn't wear your seatbelt. Well, that's true, except that if you happen to be the person who's in an accident and the seatbelt saves your life, it could be great that you have a seatbelt on. So it's hard to generalize from sort of averages out there to the individual patient.
And briefly, you say this whole antidepressant debate obscures larger social issues. Give us some examples.
Well, basically, we know that most people with depression, about half or arguably most, don't get any treatment for depression at all. And we know that whites get treated more than African Americans and Latinos. And most people, when they if they do happen to get treatment, unfortunately, they're in insurance plans that don't cover psychotherapy. So at best, maybe they'll get a doctor to give them an antidepressant, and they won't be able to sort of engage in psychotherapy, which may be more helpful for them or other things. So this is part of a larger issue, which is we need to increase awareness of the fact that there are people who are depressed and decrease the stigma and get people into treatment.
Dr. Robert Klitzman of Columbia University is the author of When Doctors Become Patients from Oxford University Press. We also heard from Newsweek science editor Sharon Begley.
Antidepressants from our January 31st, 2010 Newsweek on-air broadcast. Last week, there was news of a new study showing increasing numbers of college students, especially freshmen and especially women, increasingly stressed and depressed by campus pressures and doubts about their future job prospects. Also, an Army Inspector General's report found that from a quarter to a third of all soldiers in special care units for the wounded are over-medicated, abuse prescriptions, and have access to illegal drugs. I'm Michael So. We'll visit the archive again next week.